Tech Bubble until now has focused, as you would perhaps expect, on school-related issues. This, our fourth season, the latest episode explores the impact of artificial intelligence on learning and teaching, with the rapid speed of change brought by AI unlikely to slow down anytime soon. That is, if the 2023 summer vacation is anything to go by.
In the future, we see quite significant additional use for AI. We think there will likely be full contract automation, where first drafts of contracts to a fairly sophisticated degree can be drafted entirely by AI.
That was the voice of Andrew Brereton, a managing partner working for King & Spalding in Singapore, one of the leading commercial law firms in the world, a close friend since high school, and also a graduate of Cambridge University.
For most, AI is going to present new opportunities, but also new risks. And with some of these risks, they could actually be existential and put entire businesses at risk, making them at risk of becoming obsolete.
Paul is an accountant and a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers in capital markets and accounting advisory services in Toronto, Canada, one of the world's largest accountancy and consultancy firms. Also a close friend since our time together at Warwick University.
Today on the Tech Bubble, we consider the impact of AI, not just in school, but also across several sectors, thinking about the future of work for South Island School students once we have graduated. What is that future likely to look like?
It's been a challenging few months for education as a plethora of new AI-based apps flood the market, and educational facilities grapple with what this means for the industry. During the summer vacation, I myself have been experimenting with a number of AI tools, such as Runway ML, and have already seen the incredible creative benefits these tools can bring. However, the speed of change is so rapid that just as we get a handle on the potential benefits and pitfalls of AI, the next new shift occurs. For instance, in the most recent podcast episode of Your Undivided Attention by the Center for Humane Technology, the main guest was legal scholar Nita Fahani, who was discussing the emergence of affordable neurotechnology and her call to urgently protect our internal thoughts, the so-called cognitive liberty. Today we consider the response to AI in other sectors, such as law and accountancy, to find out the current situation, how AI is being used, and what representatives from those industries think may happen with generative AI in the future.
So let's get started with the here and now. How is AI being used? We asked our guests to reflect on how AI is already being used in the workplace.
It's actually been used for some time and has evolved from basic things that most people will have used in Word, for example, document search functions that allow you to search for specific words within large documents, blackline functions, which enable you to compare two documents and see what changes have been made. And document production software, where you fill in a checklist based on pre-programmed variables and it produces a first draft of a contract. That's evolved into a number of current uses, for example, e-discovery, where in litigation, each side has to disclose to the other all the documents that they rely on in evidence, and that tends to result in massive over-disclosure to bog down the other side. And in that context, AI can search those documents for relevant terms, relevant issues, and flag those to a lawyer for further review. Similar uses are applied in mergers and acquisitions, where there's a need to review a large volume of documentation in the context of due diligence on a merger or an acquisition. We also see in things like condition precedent automation, where there are certain things that have to be done before a deal can close. And we see currently software which can scrape that list of conditions precedent from the documentation, populate that into a checklist, and then track the status of each item against uploads of relevant documents to a website. We're also seeing the development of more advanced document automation, and we're even seeing simple documents be fully automated.
It's interesting to see that AI is already underpinning many current practices associated with the role of the lawyer. But this isn't without potential problems or ramifications.
There is also an application currently for use in legal research, but that comes with a big health warning. There was recently a case in the US where a lawyer used ChatGPT for the purposes of legal research, and it simply made up cases that did not exist. And unfortunately, that lawyer put those cases into his brief in support of his argument and was severely criticised by the judge in question.
We asked Andy whether he did foresee a use for AI in legal research.
We also see that there could be the use of AI in research and preparation of draft advice or draft court pleadings. And for large-scale due diligence review, taking it beyond the current capabilities so that not only can it review and flag key terms, but it will have a better understanding of what those issues mean and perhaps be able to prepare a first draft of a due diligence report. All of those things will still need to be reviewed by a lawyer who has a broader understanding both of the market context and the specific issues of that deal, including their client's requirements.
So ultimately, we would be interested in finding out, do you think that AI is likely to make lawyers obsolete?
So, like all previous uses of technology in the legal profession, I think it's very unlikely that it will make lawyers obsolete. Rather, it will automate the more commoditized and, frankly, the more boring legal tasks and free up lawyers to focus on more interesting and higher value tasks, which can still, and I believe will still, for the foreseeable future, only be performed by humans.
We took these findings to Lauren Sharman, head of post-secondary engagement at South Island School, and as many of our students will tell you, a huge support in helping our senior community in writing and being accepted into universities all around the world. We asked Lauren just how popular this pathway has been for our students in recent years. And I'm sure that these opinions will be well received amongst those within our alumni community committed to law degrees, as well as those of you applying in the current cohort.
It's consistently very, very popular at South Island School. We have consistent applications to a range of destinations. Obviously, law isn't offered at undergraduate level in every country. So Hong Kong and the UK is the two main sending destinations for our law applicants. And it's interesting when you're advising students thinking about law, is that wider skill set that they need to have in place before they're going to be successful on that degree. So for instance, the vast amount of reading they have to do weekly on that degree is maybe something they're not very prepared for. And so we have students applying to a wide range of schools because law is popular in lots of different types of universities in the UK. And I think what's interesting about the whole AI role of that is that I think it might aid some students getting their head around very complex concepts quite quicker than they maybe did in the past. But I do think that they are not going to be able to get around the fact that you are going to have to read vast quantities. Just to give you some idea of stats, there was a weird blip in 2022 that we only had 8 students apply for law, but the previous year in 2021 we had 18 students. And it is, like I say, consistently a popular course for our students here at South Island School.
Do you think that there is more that we could be doing for those students in terms of getting them used to that sort of, you know, massive pressure of reading that it isn't really part of the IB diploma to the same degree, is it?
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because you're trying to encourage that breadth of experience in the IB, but of course they are working to quite specific sort of criteria, I guess, in the IB. So I would say that the IB does set them up in a lot of ways for law, thinking about critical thinking and critical analysis skills, making decisions under pressure, being able to write about how you feel about things. But yes, you have to have a natural penchant for wanting to read and understand to a deep level, I think, which could be even something like an after-school activity where you're taking complex ideas that are out in the popular culture world and seeing what people think, getting used to debating how they feel about things. Certainly MUN sets itself up nicely for those kind of transferable skills for that.
There you go, Amana. That's your next after-school activity. You're clearly not running enough at the moment.
One of the big things I need to make students aware of in the UK is that there is a pre-admissions test for most universities now for law. It's called the LNAT, and it's something students have to prepare for themselves. And it's quite high pressured because, unfortunately, the students don't get their results in time for making the application. The result comes out after the UCAS system is closed, which seems a bit unfair. You know, the kids aren't allowed to know their parameters they're working within. So they're having to practice, they're having to do this alongside their IB, and having to trust the fact that they are able to demonstrate their ability to reason and think in a complex way under test conditions, which seems very tricky.
It is. And as a father who's seen my own son go through that process, applying for law at university, it was a big part of what put him off certain universities, because his feeling was that the LNAT was being required before he'd been taught about law, and decisions were being made about his potential suitability or not, as the case may be, to get into some universities. So I know that, for instance, Oxford, Durham, and I think one of the big London schools as well insisted on an LNAT score, whereas places like Warwick and Southampton, which are also very highly rated law courses, didn't. And that was a big part of swaying him in terms of his decision making as well. So thank you for that.
To that point, actually, it's really interesting, this whole idea of putting people off. I think when students are applying for a subject that they haven't yet experience. They haven't been taught law before, as you made the point. I think it's really interesting how those students demonstrate their interest in their application, because how can they possibly know? And often students go to doing a work placement as a way of proving that they know what they're talking about. Actually, some of the more competitive schools have said that that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for these transferable skills. So it is a student who genuinely loves history or English, the fact they are using their critical thinking skills, analysis skills in essays and taking new topics and engaging with them on a deep level. And so you're right, it's interesting that your son having that point, well, I've not done law before, why are you needing this ahead of time? But I believe the LNAT is trying to tease out some of those transferable skills with that. Although I would hope that someone would have a strong interest in how justice or the legal systems do work in various countries around the world.
I think the other pressure point for our students is the fact that, you know, as we've discussed many times, the IB diploma is so difficult. You know, there's so much work to cover, there's so much content to cover, that in preparing yourself for the LNAT as well, that's a huge additional responsibility. And from his perspective, I think he had to make the decision as to whether he was going to concentrate, you know, on trying to maximise the scores he was getting out of the diploma, or whether he needed to put more time into the LNAT preparation work. And sooner or later, I think that becomes a little bit of a toss-up between the two. And it places students in a situation where they've got to make a choice. Obviously, there are some who are successful and maybe are more ready for those kind of courses, you know, straight out of the gates. They have already developed the kind of skills that make them successful in an LNAT context. Whereas for other students, I think they require a different pathway. And I think that's why, from his perspective, a university like Warwick was so helpful, because they kind of welcome that approach. They are sort of expecting that students are starting with nothing and are going to develop those skills whilst they're there with them. So an interesting little case study, Lauren, for us to think about.
Janice Wong is a technology policy advisor at the Law Society, where her work touches upon data privacy, AI and law tech, cybersecurity and access to justice. She has appeared on the Tech Bubble before and is a former head prefect of our school.
In context of using more legal technology or law tech by lawyers and those that work in the legal profession, one piece of research that the Law Society of England and Wales commissioned earlier in 2023 found that while there is appetite and awareness of the ways in which such technologies can improve efficiencies that meet client demands, it was acknowledged that behavioral changes as well as organizational changes are needed to ensure that everyone can benefit in the long term. Although adopting technology can be seen as a driver for innovation in the legal sector, it is important to remember that there are huge differences in capabilities and resources when comparing the large law firms that have dedicated technologies and teams versus just much smaller firms that make up the majority of the profession, where perhaps only one or two lawyers are not only responsible for legal work, but also cybersecurity, administrative, and data protection measures too.
Accountancy is another respected profession and mainstay of education. We asked Paul Feetham of PricewaterhouseCoopers about how he got into accountancy and how AI can be impacting the industry.
So as a bit of background, to become a qualified accountant took me 3 years of studying and passing exams, as well as the 3 years I spent at university. When I look at what AI could mean to that, well, ChatGPT has actually just successfully passed the CPA exam, which is the US qualification to become an accountant. And ChatGPT managed a score of 85%.
We asked Lauren Sharman about accountancy uptake for students applying from South Island School. In addition, in recent years, which courses are proving to be the most popular and why?
I think it's interesting working at South Island School because in this region, certain courses are usually time and time again popular. And it's usually the courses that families feel buy some sort of security in a world that's not very secure. So law is very popular, as I've already said, psychology, business, engineering, and medicine is also incredibly popular. So we have less students usually applying to things like accountancy, which is much more specialised, or even finance. So just to give you some numbers, in 2022, we only had one student go off to do accountancy and one in 2021. Finance as a whole is more popular, I would say, but then business and economics is our biggest kind of cohort, really, around 30 students choosing to study it each year. And I think there's a interesting dichotomy there. You know, why do people feel business is more stable as a route to go into when clearly accountancy sets you up to then be a specialist in your subject? Some of these courses that you do at university exempt you from some of the entrance tests or the exams you have to take to become a certified accountant. And so specialising and getting more sort of career bang for your buck, I guess, seems to make a lot of sense, but a lot of students are afraid of specialising so soon out of high school, which I guess I can understand too. I think there's some shift, well, not shift even, at South Island School, it's a real joy to work here because we have such an interest in a wide range of subjects. And I say it every year at my staff briefing about where the students have gone every year. It would be quite dull doing my job if you only had the same five courses being applied for every year, but we don't. We have a huge breadth here. The arts are very, very strong, down to people like you, Mr. Williamson. You know, the people who come in and apply for film is quite large at this school, and that's not the case at other schools. So every year it's a new joy. There's always some usual suspects, but every year I'm surprised by some interesting courses that are being applied for. And what's also interesting is the differences in country that's popular. So obviously, historically, Hong Kong has a very strong link with the UK, and so that's always our biggest sending destination. But over the past few years, Hong Kong has been very popular. It's very affordable here. It felt very safe during COVID. Maybe some courses aren't as interesting to study here than others, and there are some social interesting issues. Apparently, things like the social scene in Hong Kong universities isn't as rich as it might be in other countries. We always have a standard amount of people apply to the US, but very few actually go because it's so expensive. Or they're often applying for very sort of brand name schools that have tiny admit rates. So yeah, it's interesting to see the landscape shift a little bit every year, but it's a real joy to work with the breadth and diversity we have.
So we want to find out a little bit more about how you've seen AI being used in higher education. So in what different ways can students prepare themselves by using AI, and also how is this being used in the industries?
It's a really interesting question because as research and leading universities are meant to be, they are actually quite afraid of change. And so this AI development that's happened so fast has really, I think, scared a lot of universities. They're having to think a lot like schools are in how we're going to embrace it, how are we going to guide our applicants, what do we see as appropriate. And so the sort of professional development that Mr. Williamson and people from the school have given the teachers has really calmed my fears about using it. It's a tool that we need to embrace and just give students some guidelines about it. And it seems like universities are saying the same thing. You know, plagiarism has always been a problem. Well, not a problem, something we're trying to dissuade people from doing. Understanding what that looks like is really important. And so ChatGPT doesn't change that at all, for instance, if you're going to use that as a tool to generate some ideas. And so interestingly, literally last week when I was conducting a UCAS interview, someone brought me a really interesting personal statement, but there were two telltale things about it that made me ask more questions. And the first was they were using language that felt very awkward. It didn't feel genuine to the student. And so I've always, over the years, had to ask, have you been using a thesaurus to write this? And invariably the answer is yes, and they don't use those words naturally. And so using words that you are natural with is really important because it's your personal statement, so it's personal to you. And then the second thing was it felt very robotic. It read very robotically. And so I just said, have you used it to generate some ideas? And they said, absolutely, you know, and they weren't in trouble. But I said, really, at this stage now, we need to put you back into this personal statement. We're missing the specifics that make this you. What are you interested in? What depth have you gone to in your looking at this particular course? And so, yeah, embracing it, using it as a tool to get people started, because writing personal statements can be very intimidating. How do you start with a blank piece of paper and sell yourself to a university? That depends your whole future on it. You know, it's hugely high stakes for students. So a starting point is a great place to go, as long as then they remember to go put themselves really into that. And that's really why I have a job, to spot it when the students aren't being specific enough about their personal interests. Universities are saying very similar things. They're not going too specific about the guidance they're giving, just that they're working on their policies and procedures. So I don't know the details about what's happening actually when you're a student at university, but I think it'll be very similar to what our approach is.
And this is one of the big concerns that people have with AI at the moment. It's not the idea that AI is suddenly going to become sentient. It's the idea that we are going to pour out so much of our own personal information to the AI bots that we're being encouraged to use, that ultimately, because what I was thinking as you were responding there, Lauren, is an AI form is not going to be able to do that. It's not going to be able to put you back into the statement unless you've told it absolutely everything about yourself, to the degree that it becomes an emotional connection, an emotional support, which obviously has huge implications in terms of, you know, the sort of surveillance and data privacy issues associated with particularly, you know, younger members of our community oversharing, giving too much information, which then means that big technological firms have unprecedented data and information about the way in which we're using these technological forms. But I think at least for now, I think what you seem to be saying loud and clear is that while students can get started using, you know, AI conversations and get ideas from it, they've really got to think carefully about making sure that they themselves are at the heart of these applications. And that's more likely to open doors than some preconceived idea of what makes a good personal statement, because obviously it's going to change from one university to the next and one course to the next as well.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's interesting how possibly it's very easy to spot it now, but maybe it won't be in the future, as you say. And so again, it's dovetailing our kind of digital leadership stuff that we do in school, making sure they understand about how to only share what you're comfortable sharing, and the fact that your emotional response to some content or your passion for a subject is one of your most valuable assets, and that can't be replaced by a machine. Certainly if we make sure that you use it as a starting point and not the be all and end all. I'd be interested to see as things develop, you know, if you can make a more authentic teenage voice in a AI generated statement, that might be a bigger problem. But at the moment, you know, anyone who knows teenagers is very easy to spot when they haven't really written it themselves.
Really, really good advice. Thank you, Lauren.
So I think it's quite interesting listening to the conversation between Mr. Williamson and Ms. Sharman and the subsequent implications for students as well. My key takeaway has been that we need to be nuanced in the adoption of generative AI. We need to be quite careful not to form emotional connections with the technology we use, but we can still use them as study buddies or even something like a personal tutor. I was quite curious as to how this could play out, especially in other industries. So we asked Paul Feetham what the advent of AI means for accountants.
The question that most people are going to ask is immediately is, will I ever be needed again? I think the answer, in my view, for that is 100% yes. What will certainly change, though, are the skills and the experiences that accountants will need. And for us, that typically starts with education, and that's students at schools and in universities, and the courses are the most relevant going forward. And that shift will be, you know, to incorporate and adopt and adapt to topics using AI, and understanding what it can and can't do, and also what it should and shouldn't be used for.
Amana, I thought these words would really resonate with you. I mean, for those listeners who didn't already know, Amana has been pushing the use of AI in school for several years through her club Tech Connect. More recently, this club has extended outside of the school through her initiative Youth for Youth, which has served several schools, including two of our feeder primary schools, Quarry Bay and Bradbury. I mean, how would you respond to Paul's points? What can and can't AI do? And also, what should and shouldn't it be used for?
I definitely agree that AI will create far more jobs than it destroys, but I think that the nature of those jobs will really be quite different to the jobs that we have today. I think if young people are to remain equipped to handle the world and the future industries that they will have to work in, they won't just need knowledge, but they will also need the creativity and the skills to apply this knowledge. So my initiative, Youth for Youth, focuses on exposing students to unique applications of AI in different industries to inspire them to create similar solutions. I think that skills like coding, 3D modeling, and animation that Youth for Youth teaches younger generations using the latest technological software are the skills that are currently required in the industry. While technology will definitely take over numerous fields, if the workforce of tomorrow is able to acquire these kinds of skills that will be needed in future careers, then they can prevent themselves from becoming redundant. However, I also want to highlight that there are some industries where we will always need humans, for reasons that we can't really articulate. For example, a computer might determine the outcome of a criminal case perfectly, but we would still want a human judge to take responsibility for such an important decision. Emotion recognition software might be better than your therapist at understanding your feelings because technology is already advanced enough to do this. But we want to be understood by a human. Regardless of how efficiently a computer can grade our coursework, students will respond best to inspiring human teachers. Although a machine has been capable of finishing the Harry Potter series for a long time, fans would not be satisfied. They need the story to come from one particular human mind. Therefore, I think that we should stop asking what AI will never be able to achieve, because the answer is definitely nothing. I mean, you can see it time and time again in history. People say that AI will never be able to do this, and then it just proves them wrong. So I think we should start asking what skills we wouldn't let machines perform instead, even if they could perform them better than us. I think the main point is that humans need humanness. So that's what will retain market value.
I think that's so interesting that you've placed, you know, such an importance on the human abilities that simply cannot be, I think, replaced by AI. There are and you know, why would we want to do that as well? There are going to be big questions, I think, for us to ask as a society going forward in terms of what we value about what it means to be human. And it's very interesting that Paul Feetham seems to agree with some of the sentiment that you've just described.
So AI will initially become an enabler and rather than a replacement for accountants. We see it as becoming a tool that will drive efficiency, augment skills and services that we provide to our clients. And this is what's kept me in the profession for as long as I have been. Honestly, constant change in the skills I need to learn and develop, as well as the challenges our clients are facing and need the help they need in solving those challenges. So how is AI impacting PwC and our clients? To give you a sense of how PwC as an accounting firm is innovating and adapting to AI, we actually recently announced a $1 billion investment alongside Microsoft to expand our AI solutions for our own clients. So our focus is going to be to help our clients adopt alongside Microsoft-based AI technologies in a responsible way. And that's the role we play to really support and push forward the agenda around responsible use of AI, and one that doesn't undermine trust in the company or in its activities. And we're also starting the process of training and upskilling all of our own employees on AI and applications that we can use, both to augment the work we already do, to both enhance efficiency and also to improve quality.
It's also interesting to see that PricewaterhouseCoopers' approach isn't that far apart from the ESF, in so much as both recognize the need for upskilling and change. AI features on the SIS development plan this year, and I'll be responsible for leading that training with staff.
So to close, for me, AI represents massive opportunities for the profession, for our firm and for our clients. However, these opportunities also bring significant risks, and our profession has a huge role to play in supporting and underpinning the responsible adoption of AI into businesses, given the governance role we play with most companies, with regulators, and also with governments. AI will be disruptive to many traditional business models in much the same way, or probably more so, than e-commerce has been disruptive. But change isn't going to stop, and we have to continue to adapt and learn new skills in order to remain relevant. and to have a voice in ensuring that technology that is adopted and implemented is done so in a responsible way for the benefit of society and in the long run.
More broadly, while developing technical skills such as coding or prompt engineering may be useful, we also need the non-technical and human skills such as creativity, dynamic thinking, and the ability to understand the nuances of intonation and language to make the most out of the digital tools we develop.
Well, you might have been able to detect that we had some new music in that episode. So thank you very much for a fantastic new intro and outro, which was designed by Utkarsh Goyal in year 12. And also, we have a new editor as well. Thank you very much to Alexis Liu for a really fantastic job of putting the episode together. That's just about all we have time for today. So I'd like to thank our excellent guests. That was Andrew Brereton, Paul Feetham, Lauren Sharman and Janice Wong. We'll be back soon with episode 21, the third in our series focusing on the challenges and opportunities afforded across various industries with AI tech in 2023 and 2024.
What would you like to discuss? If you have any ideas, questions or feedback, then please write to digileaders@webmail.sis.edu.hk. That's DIGI. And don't forget to rate or like the show on Spotify, YouTube, or wherever possible.